Welcome to The Open Circuit, a podcast about technology, security, and cybercrime. I'm your host, R.V. Gundur. Joining me today is Dr. Jonathan Lusthaus. Jonathan is the director of the Human Cybercriminal Project in the Department of Sociology at the University of Oxford. His work focuses on the organization of profit-driven cybercrime. He has a book on the subject, Industry of Anonymity, Inside the Business of Cybercrime. That book was published by Harvard University Press in late 2018. Today, we're going to be talking about how folks become offenders and develop criminal enterprises in cyberspace. Jonathan, thank you for joining me.
Thanks very much for having me.
When the public thinks of cybercrime, there is often an optic of some technological whiz hacking into computer systems. But this doesn't really map onto reality, does it? What is encompassed when we talk about cybercrime?
So cybercrime is really much broader than people think. So there's different views on this matter. Some people take a very narrow view. Some people take a broader view, which is the camp that I fit into. What I see it as is really crime that uses technology in a significant way. So we can try and look for brand new, very novel things that make cybercrime this kind of magical, fantastical type of place. But I don't really see it like that. When you boil it down, you're really starting to see very traditional types of crime. So we see fraud, we see theft, we see extortion, we see all the types of crime that we've seen really throughout history, but now we're seeing it carried out with new methods and in new locations. So we're seeing the virtual and the cyber element kind of being matched on to these existing crime types. So this is something that Peter Grabowski has been talking about for decades. And so having done a lot of work in this area in terms of interviews and going out into the field, I really ended up back at the same point that that Peter had begun at, which is this idea that it's not really anything particularly new. It's old crime carried out in new ways.
Given the diversity of cybercrimes, what do we know about how cybercriminals get started in their criminal careers, even though they're old crimes in new ways?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a complicated question in the sense that there isn't really one type of cybercriminal. So that's another point that we kind of talk about in a very general way. We talk about this idea of cybercriminals, but the problem there is that there isn't one type of cybercriminal. So when we start to think about how do they get involved in cybercrime, how do their careers progress in this area, it's not one narrative. And I'll give you two examples that are kind of at the opposite ends of the spectrum. So one would be something that we think about conventionally in relation to cybercrime. So people may be involved in hacking, maybe involved in the more technical aspects of cybercrime, so programming, different types of things like this. And so in that kind of space, you might see a sort of evolution where someone's maybe starting out relatively young, where they get involved in aspects of cyber, could be completely legitimate aspects of cyber. They're sort of just playing around, they're learning about how things work, they're learning about programming, they might start learning about different aspects of subverting programming or subverting code that they're finding in subverting software. And so over time, they might then evolve into sort of different circles where they're learning about different components that are much closer to pure cybercrime. And so one of the sort of phrases that I like out of one of the former cybercriminals that I interviewed during my fieldwork was this idea of social bubbles, that people move between these social bubbles. So you start out in something that's sort of fairly legitimate or sort of neutral, and then there's a sort of slippery slope that might take you over time towards more criminal sort of areas. That's one kind of story, but the other one is completely different, which is there are certain people involved in cybercrime that are, you know, just conventional criminals, really. These are people that have been involved in other types of crime, and so their story is quite different. Their profile is quite different. So these might be people that aren't involved at the technical end at all. They don't really have any hacking ability, any type of coding ability. Their role might be more, for instance, on the money side of things. They're the ones that are managing what's called cashing out, which is converting these sort of virtual gains into physical or monetary ones. And so the skill set required there is not at all the same. And so the people involved in that area is not necessarily the same. And so their story might be quite different, which is they're involved in a different type of crime. Then they're looking for opportunities and they see an opportunity to take their skill set and apply it to something that's, you know, more virtual, more cyber, but still plays on what their kind of core abilities are and their core resources are. So you might see that people getting involved in credit card fraud, simply buying card data online, converting it into counterfeit credit cards or debit cards, and then going out and purchasing products or doing ATM withdrawals. So these are kind of the different types of careers you can have. There's a whole spectrum in between, but that's the sort of two ends that you might see in terms of how people get involved.
One of the themes that comes up as we consider various types of cyber criminal enterprises is geography. What role does geography play in how cyber criminals develop their enterprises?
Yeah, so that's a good question, and it kind of ties in with what I was just talking about there in terms of the range of different people involved and the different skill sets involved in cybercrime. So geography actually plays a very important role in the sense that it's helping to define how certain people do come to get involved in this world of cybercrime. So as much as we might have different specialties based on skill set and resources, some of that's tied to where people come from. So if we think about different countries around the world, cybercrime is not universally distributed in terms of where the offenders are and what they're doing and how impactful they are. What I found in the work that I was doing was that often you find kind of hubs placed around the world where you're seeing really a higher concentration of cybercriminal activity, or certainly at that higher end of cybercriminal activity. So in that case, what you begin to see is certain countries become almost like regional specialty hubs. So they're not known for cybercrime in general, they're known for particular types of cybercrime. So if we think about it, that very technical higher end, the end of sort of malware coding, these types of activities, what you see is often the really top people in that area are coming from, say, former Soviet Union countries. They're coming from a social, political, and economic background that's really built in a core set of skills and resources that's very well suited to carrying out that type of endeavor. So these are people who are often, you know, very capable, very intelligent, highly educated, sometimes with multiple university degrees, that the job market doesn't really provide a lot of opportunities. And so what you're seeing is people who could play a very, very significant role in legitimate business, in the legitimate tech sector, but don't have that pathway in. And so in a sense, what they're doing is creating their own cyber criminal businesses and getting involved in those businesses in different ways. So that's one sort of example in terms of geography. But then if you flip over to somewhere else like Romania or Nigeria, you see much more of a fraud-based type of cybercrime model. And so in those cases, you're not seeing a really large talent pool of offenders who are highly skilled and highly educated in technical components. You're seeing people who are very sharp, very capable, very smart, but what they're doing is getting involved in really core types of scams. So in the Romania example, what they're famous for traditionally is called online auction fraud. So it's basically selling things on eBay and other platforms that don't exist. It's a very simple scam. The Nigerian scam that's very famous is a 419 scam, or advanced fee fraud is basically, this classic email that you might have received over many years now of, you know, here is some sort of inheritance or some sort of money that's available, but they need your help to unlock this. And if you can just provide them with a small fee to pay the lawyer or pay the charge or whatever it might be, then you'll get to share in this huge profit. So you see again in those examples that the kind of offender sample that's getting involved in this are coming out of the environments that they're from. So the geography plays an important role. You're not seeing those higher technical offenders in those places because quite simply either there isn't the same background that's producing them in terms of the university system or in terms of the opportunity structure, but you're seeing a different type of offender get involved, which is one that's much more closely aligned with a kind of fraud model. So that's very important. And you see this across the world, that different countries produce different types of cybercrime that's based very much on the opportunities that are available and on the lack of opportunity that's there.
In your book, you talk about how cyber criminals collaborate, sometimes across these international borders that you were just talking about. What kinds of businesses do collaboration efforts facilitate?
Yeah, so that's also an important question because that's really looking at how you see the linkages between these different groups of offenders. So they might be based in different countries around the world. And in a sense, they've got these different specializations that they're particularly known for. But to carry out cybercrime, you actually need a number of different people playing different roles within any enterprise, really. So as we've talked about earlier, you know, you often need someone more involved in the technical component or someone more involved in the cash side of things. And so you need to fit these people together. And sometimes if they're located in different countries, you need really those linkages internationally. So if we take the example, we're just talking about geography there, different countries specializing in different types of cybercrime. If you think about the West, what role does the West play within cybercrime? What role are they specializing in? And that role is really one of being at the forefront of the cashing out side of cybercrime. So in a sense, what we're seeing here is people who have access to the Western financial system are on the ground in the West. So if you're running a big scam and you need to do credit card fraud or you're doing banking fraud or things like this, it's highly suspicious if you're running this entirely overseas and you're targeting, say, the US or the UK or Australia or other countries. And so it's actually a big asset if you have people on the ground in those countries who can run the money side of things, who can set up accounts locally, bank accounts, who can do ATM withdrawals locally, or who can, you know, buy things in shops locally. And that gives these operations much more credibility and much more a greater ability to sort of evade some of the mechanisms that have been put in place to try and stop this type of activity. So in a sense, what you're seeing there is the local specialty in the West becomes one that's very much tied to cashing out, very much tied to this money side of cybercrime. And that is allowed by the fact that they have these linkages overseas with the people who are kind of the producers or the suppliers who are really providing a lot of the kind of technical know-how or the core leadership of a number of these scams and these types of operations. And that's kind of the natural partnership that you're going to see between what is the kind of the technical and the business and the brain side of things, and then the people who are handling the money component. And you need those elements to intertwine, and sometimes that's an international process.
That level of sophistication is fascinating, but how do cyber criminals manage to trust each other, particularly when they don't get to meet each other necessarily?
Yeah, so the trust question is one that's very close to my heart. It's something that's really fascinated me, because for me, what you're looking at is really interesting puzzle in relation to cybercrime. I think a number of scholars have looked at the question of how do criminals cooperate with each other, because these are people that you think of as not particularly law-abiding, because that's really what defines them. So if they're going to go into business with each other, there's any disputes, they can't go to the state, they can't go to the police, they can't go to the law courts to resolve their disputes, because their disputes are outside of the system. And so that creates a very interesting trust problem. But if you take cybercrime, you don't just have that particular trust problem, you have an added one, which is often if these people are operating online, they don't know who they're dealing with, or even if they do know, they might be in a different country. It might be very difficult to, you know, enforce things physically. So they can't go and beat someone up, they can't go and see them, they can't put pressure on them. And that creates a number of challenges for them. So one of the things that really has fascinated me over the past years and the time that I've been doing research on this subject is how do they overcome this trust problem? And so I spent quite a long time really gathering data, trying to understand this question. And what I found quite interesting is that we often think that we're going to find something particularly new or innovative in cybercrime. And there's certainly that in relation to a number of the schemes that they're carrying out. But what I saw in relation to the trust question is that rather than inventing anything particularly new, they're leveraging things that have existed and worked for humans in a whole bunch of other contexts throughout time. And so what we see in terms of how they cooperate and how they trust each other is that they're using things like reputation, so things we know very well, you know, that you want to work with people that you know, that you've had past experience with, that other people in your circle know that they can vouch for or make referrals. That's hugely important to cyber criminals online. Also, you know, we see things in relation to what you might think of as performance, which is that they're essentially trying to give other collaborators tests that they might have to pass. So they might do a small job first before they get involved with them in a much bigger, more extensive way. So they're really trying to build up cooperation in this gradual way so they can start to kind of gather information on a potential partner rather than just dive in on a big deal, which has a huge amount of risk. So that's what this is about, is really dropping the risk involved in this. And then we see what's really interesting in relation to cybercrime is how appearance plays a role. Because, you know, you want to be able to assess people from the way they engage with you, from the way they might appear. So in the offline world, we have, you know, a lot of practice at this for better or for worse. In cyber, the challenge is that you can invent a brand new persona, that you can basically create a new identity or one that's been structured by you for particular purposes. And so the challenge faced by cyber criminals in that particular situation is how to evaluate who can be trusted, who's safe to work with and who's not, who is potentially an undercover agent. And so for them, it becomes very important to be able to assess these types of things. And it's quite challenging. So really, there's multiple things that can be changed. But what I found is there's certain key markers that are difficult to change. One of those is really the language that you speak. So, you know, if you're pretending to be a Russian cyber criminal, you kind of have to speak fluent Russian to be able to do that, and maybe native level Russian, actually. And so that's a strong marker of someone's legitimate identity based on what they're saying. And also the time spent online. So the amount of time you've invested in building up a profile is really important. If you've been out there in the community for years in cyber, that's a huge amount of time. And so the cost that you would face by burning that profile, by burning that reputation with ripping someone off or doing whatever, you would then have to start again. And so time spent online, while not preventing people ripping each other off, does strongly signal that there's, you know, there's an investment there and they're probably safer to deal with. So these are the kind of important things in terms of trust. And added to that is the final one, which is really enforcement, that cyber criminals have developed ways of enforcing arrangement, of enforcing deals. But again, they're doing this in the same way that we do this in other aspects of life. So they've invented sort of quasi-arbitration systems. They have these kind of informal legal cases. When they have a dispute online, someone will be appointed to arbitrate that dispute. They provide evidence in each side, and then a decision can be made. And the other one is escrow. So just as if we were buying a house, we want to trust a third party who can hold a large amount of money before to check that the deal is going to go through and that everything's legitimate. Cyber criminals who are doing large deals might also bring someone on to play that role because they don't necessarily trust each other. So that's kind of what we see in a very broad overview as to how they're working in overcoming this trust problem. And as I mentioned, they're doing it not by creating anything particularly new or innovative, but finding the things that work already in other settings and applying them to this one.
Speaking of settings, one element that is often forgotten is what happens offline to help cybercriminals and their activities. You have written about how the business of cybercrime unfolds in Romania. On the ground, what does it look like?
Yeah, so the offline component is really one of the most surprising things that I found during the research that I did, because I think the assumption is that cyber is an online thing. It's a virtual thing, and that's what you go looking for. And so I was quite surprised the further I got into this, how many offenders are known to each other in a physical setting so that they know each other in person, and really how important it is that particular offenders are embedded within particular contexts. And so part of this relates to this trust problem question, that if you can choose to work with people that you already know, that you're in the same social networks, that you have some type of physical enforcement option should you want it, it removes some of those challenges I was talking about earlier. So it removes the anonymity problem. So then you're just left with the criminal problem in terms of trust. And so that actually is a strong reason why you might want to operate in these types of offline environments and be known to people that you're collaborating with. So that's not a choice everyone makes, but I saw that in relation to a number of settings. So if we think back to the Romanian case I was talking about, a number of Romanian offenders are known to each other in person. These are people who potentially might have grown up together. They might have gone to the same schools, come from the same neighborhoods, gone to the same universities. There's a strong sort of network element to this. And so what you find is entering those groups is really tied very much to being known and being trusted already in an offline sense. And so what this looks like in practice is really a very sort of industrial type of operation. So that type of scam, that online auction fraud, seems like a very simple scam, which is, you know, you advertise a product online. It could be traditionally a car. Someone buys the car doesn't exist, that's a scam. Very simple scam. But the organization behind it is a lot more sophisticated. So these are structured groups. They have clear roles. There's clear hierarchies. And they have clear processes in place. So even in relation to the scam, they might have particular scripts that have been written up so that someone who's engaging with the potential victims will have kind of core responses they can go to rather than having to come up with something every time they engage with a victim. It's just good business to be able to have a set protocol that can be given to new people. They then apply the protocol, they provide this response in this particular case, and it goes on like this. You know, the level of sophistication in terms of their ability to create fake documents, you know, if they're trying to lease out a property, to create something that looks very much like a lease, it looks very much like a legitimate document that shows that they have the right to rent out this this particular property. So they're very sophisticated in that sense, and this is often built around working together physically. So they will, in a number of cases, work in the same physical location. I encountered cases where they're working out of apartment blocks, and then they would move regularly between apartments to evade police. So they're moving in order to maintain and protect their operation. So it becomes something that you expect to see much more in business or to see in traditional crime. And it really, that offline element allows them to build up the sophistication, to build up the professionalism that then online allows them to operate much more effectively. And so that's the kind of connection between the two.
Throughout your career, you have spoken to a diverse cross-section of people who know about cybercrime from the perspective of law enforcement as well as offenders. Can you tell us how you went about figuring out how you were going to collect data and how you overcame some of the challenges you faced along the way?
Yeah, so the data issue is an interesting and important one, and it was a huge part of this project, was figuring out how to get this information. So the short answer is that it took me an incredibly long time. So it was a 7-year process. I traveled to 20 different countries, interviewed 238 people. There was a huge amount of work involved and potentially a sort of crazy level of work involved in terms of the sort of obsession that I developed with really wanting to find out certain missing pieces of information that I didn't have. I just continued until I got to a level where I felt that I knew what I wanted to know. And even then, I feel like I'm just scratching the surface with this. It's a huge, huge world. There were a number of challenges in terms of getting access to different people or getting access to different types of, say, written data. There's a huge trust problem here. So as much as we're talking about trust in relation to cyber criminals cooperating with each other, as a researcher, you also have to build up trust with the people that you're interviewing. And so this was a gradual process. When I started out, to be perfectly honest, I knew nobody in this area and I knew nothing about this area. And so it began in the UK with a very small kind of pilot study. And in that case, that was the sort of first steps I was taking to learn about the subject, be educated about the subject, and start to build up contacts. What's really interesting in terms of the sampling was there was two ways I went about this. One, and initially it kind of had to be this way, was I employed purposive sampling. So I was looking for people that I thought met certain criteria that would make them of interest to the study. So these are people who, you know, would be from a law enforcement background within cybercrime, so they have particular knowledge of cases that they've investigated. People in the private sector had a similar type of profile. So they might have either been formal law enforcement or in their role, they're involved in investigation or intelligence, and they had a pretty good sense of what the cyber criminal underground was like in a particular cases within it. And then also the former cyber criminals. And so that was very, for me, a very important part of understanding this better. So you can get some very, very good information from the first two groups I talked about, but that real granular detail of what it's like, and we're talking about trust, or we're talking about these sort of micro-level interactions between cyber criminals, it's very hard to get that from anywhere else other than from the cyber criminals themselves. So that was one of the things that took me a very, very long time to sort of build connections with people from a cyber criminal background, because to me that was very, very important. So there's different ways that this can be done. As I mentioned, the purpose of sampling is important, and you might dismiss that, of course, we can't just go and look for cyber criminals, but actually you can. You know, there's a number of former cyber criminals who've left the business for one reason or another. Some of them are working in a legitimate industry now, and sometimes actually very happy to share their knowledge and share information on this world, and it's sort of very important to them. So there's that kind of most visible layer. Then, of course, you know, you can get into snowball sampling, and this applies to law enforcement and others and cyber criminals as well. You know, once you have some contacts, you can see if they can recommend you to other people. That can be very useful. It does have limits in a situation like this because there's so much trust involved that what I found was sometimes it would work, but in a lot of cases, it actually still wouldn't work. Even with a referral, certain connections just wouldn't work out. And to me, it seemed to be that, and some people didn't want to make connections either. They didn't want to refer you to, so they're quite happy to talk to you, but they didn't want to bring the risk onto anyone that they knew. And so there was, you know, some value to that snowball sampling, but there were also limitations. So I found even towards the end of the project, purposive sampling played a really important role. And it was, again, people can sort of dismiss it or laugh at it, but the amount of information you can find online, whether it's through LinkedIn, whether it's through other types of social media or other published information, you can actually start drawing up a pretty clear picture of a number of people out there from different backgrounds and start to really locate people that you want to speak to. And as long as you're persistent, eventually you probably will get to some of those people. And so that, to me, is the biggest takeaway. The final point I'd make in terms of really getting to what I saw as the Holy Grail, which was a higher number of cyber criminals within the sample, former cyber criminals. And so I should specify that former part was important to me. There's a bit of discussion, and there was discussion while I was doing this work about, you know, interviewing active or former people. I focused very much on the former offenders. And the reason for this was I viewed that, particularly in the case of cybercrime, as opposed to other types of crime, these are people who are very much hidden or trying to hide. Their anonymity is really important to them as part of like tradecraft as much as protecting themselves. And so I wanted to really move away from trying to engage with active offenders because I thought, one, they're going to be very difficult to get to. Two is if you do get to them, there's a question around the accuracy or the truthfulness of what they're going to tell you because there's obviously a lot of risk involved. And so to me, there were a number of questions there. I'm not saying it can't be done. I think there's examples where people are investigating how to do it. But in the kind of very broad approach that I was taking, you know, this 20 country type of approach, very broad, law enforcement, all sorts of people, I had to be kind of tactical in how I went about this. And for me, the higher value in this particular project was to go for former offenders. And the reason for that is I felt, and I think this was borne out by the work that I did, that they were more likely to talk, and that when they did talk, they were much more likely to be open and honest and really informative. And that was my experience with a number of people that I interviewed. Obviously, some interviews are better than others, and some you don't get much information at all. But there were certain people I spoke to who were really incredibly generous with their time and gave me all sorts of information. And, you know, I'll highlight one particular point of that was towards the end of the project, I effectively became kind of like pen pals with people who were in prison. So people who were had been convicted of cybercriminal offences, and they then were, you know, in a setting where they were sort of very happy to engage with someone who they could talk about this sort of area. In some cases, I think they viewed it as a way of kind of moving forward and trying to sort of establish what will become of their new life. And, you know, the level of detail and the level of information there was just hugely, hugely valuable to this project because, you know, the granular detail I could get from some of those interactions, I just couldn't get from anywhere else. So if I think back, having done all this work, that was really one of the key kind of components that I think was important.
Based on what you've learned from your work and the participants that you met and interacted with, how can we best fight against cybercrime?
So there are a number of different avenues for fighting against cybercrime that people promote or discuss in different ways. Obviously, there's the policing side of things. You know, what's the best way to go about doing that? There's also the kind of user side of things. So in terms of victims, you know, there's a lot of thought and discussion around how can we keep people safer? How can we educate users? How can we kind of tackle the problem from that side? These are important discussions. And, you know, I think there's a lot that can be discussed and done there. But for me, coming out of this project, the key thing that was important to me was really on the offender side, which is how can we actually look at the pathways, look at the ways, as we were talking about earlier, that people are getting involved in cybercrime, but then also, you know, in terms of the ways that people who may have been arrested or convicted, what happens to them after that point? How do we think about preventing them from returning back to cybercrime? And so for me, it was, I think the most important thing we can do is really try and hit the root causes, really try and look at why people are getting involved and try and stop that pathway. And there has been some discussion, particularly in the UK. You know, there's the prevent component of the National Crime Agency and some of the other policing units in the UK, which looks very much at trying to engage with younger offenders and trying to provide them with information about other avenues they can take and sort of shift them away from the criminal angle. The part of this that hasn't been looked at in much detail, and I think is really important if we look at the sort of international scene of cybercrime, is all these offenders around the world, some of them hugely impactful. If we think about different countries around the world, as I mentioned earlier about the former Soviet Union countries, you know, we're seeing hugely, hugely impactful offenders, not in the UK or not in Australia or not in the US necessarily. And so we need to think more about how to engage with those individuals. And as I was talking about earlier, a lot of this is about a lack of opportunity. It's a lack of access to good jobs, to good paying jobs, jobs that allow people to engage in what they're interested in. And to me, the big tragedy of this is really this very, very talented group of people, different countries around the world, who are in effect being drawn into the cybercrime world when they could offer a huge amount, because you can see this from the innovation that they apply within the cybercrime world. If we could figure out ways of really driving opportunity to these people, I think that would have a knock-on effect, not just in giving them assistance and giving them effectively this opportunity and potentially better pathways, but I think it would also reduce cybercrime overall. And that sort of double impact, I think, is something we should be looking at much more closely.
Jonathan, thank you for sharing your knowledge with us. You have been listening to Jonathan Lusthaus, Director of the Human Cybercriminal Project at the University of Oxford. If you would like to learn more about this topic, check out Jonathan's book, Industry of Anonymity, Inside the Business of Cybercrime. I'm your host, Arvi Gundur. Thanks for listening and join us next time for another episode of The Open Circuit.